Now, we were speaking yesterday about the Reformation from 1518 to 1520. And we noticed what a great stir Luther's theses made, something he had never dreamed of. The tremendous excitement that they aroused all over Europe. Now, of course, a great part of this excitement, you might say, is because of the money involved. There are those who say that the Reformation was an economic movement or that it was a political movement. The tendency in historical studies in the last few years has been to downgrade everything of religious nature and to try to make out that practically all human movements are economic or political. It is true that economic forces and political forces can greatly retard a Reformation or can help to extend it, but they are comparatively minor in the Reformation of the 16th century. It is definitely a religious movement. I think conclusive proof of that is shown in the fact that the economic and political forces that would tend to make Germany separate from Italy were just as strong in France. And in France, the Reformation had nothing like the success that it had in Italy. The movement was definitely a religious movement. And you cannot study the life of Luther without seeing that this is the great force of it. It is that which is primarily involved in the religious movement. It is true, of course, that economic forces enter, and it must be said that probably there were people in Germany who felt, isn't this awful? I wasted this money for indulgence. I got excited about that. But my inclination is to think that there are more people than that who said, I got this indulgence thinking that it would get my parents out of purgatory, and here it doesn't. I got this indulgence thinking I could live any way I wanted to, and now I find that it won't give me the protection I thought it would. That the religious factors were much more important in the spread of the interest in the indulgence in Luther's thesis than economic motives, though the others entered into some extent. Now, economic and political factors entered in to a very considerable extent in preventing the Reformation from being blotted out before it could gain any strength, or in giving it opportunity in certain areas to get a hearing. But they certainly were not the primary factors in it, nor the most important factors in it. But this tremendous excitement over Luther's theses was something which can come like a great excitement over something and people can forget it in a brief time. And if a force had come in and seized Luther and done away with him, or even if he had simply been imprisoned for the rest of his life and unable to write anything more, it would seem, humanly speaking, that there would have been no Reformation in the 16th century. Perhaps God would have raised up another man 2 centuries later. But the Reformation of the 16th century, as it began, though it made great excitement, was a little tiny candle, a little candle which could have been blown out with a whiff of wind if the wind had been rightly directed. And so it is important that we note a general summary as we start of why Luther was not quickly silenced. I mentioned yesterday, small a, there was widespread sympathy with the views he had expressed. Now, this widespread sympathy was largely a general feeling that still he was doing a good thing. This needs to be pointed out. It was not, in general, a strong enough feeling that it would have interfered seriously with a strong effort to put an end to it at that time. But nevertheless, it was a factor. Now, a much more important factor in the fact that the Reformation was not immediately stopped is B, which I mentioned yesterday, the slowness of the papacy to realize the seriousness of the situation. In the period between, say, 700 A.D. and the time of Luther, or say 20 years after the Reformation began, probably half of the popes were men who were interested in their own pleasures, their own welfare, the advancement of their relatives, and had comparatively little interest in religion. And this is particularly true during the time from about 1450 on, when the popes were pretty much like princes or dukes in different sections of Italy, trying to enlarge their own territory and looking to get all the money they could from various countries over which they had a nominal spiritual oversight, but trying to build a great capital at Rome, where they would have splendor to vie with the political rulers of the day. And as we noticed, Leo X did not take this seriously. His first reaction was, isn't that amazing that a German can write such good Latin? His next reaction was, when it was pointed out to him what it said, and so on, well, he said, if some drunken monk wrote it, once he sobers up, he will have different ideas. And it was difficult to get him really to take the thing seriously. But as the money began falling off, and much less was coming from Germany to Italy, the Pope began to see something must be done about this, and was willing to follow along with the advice of his associates in the Vatican and of opponents of Luther who came to him making recommendations for action. But the next Pope after him, whom we will discuss in detail later, realized the tremendous seriousness of it, but did not realize how strong a force it was becoming. He tried to bring in a complete reformation in the papacy and in the church without changing its doctrinal views at all, and merely got everybody disgusted at him to where, when he died within a year and a half, there were widespread rumors he'd been poisoned, and someone even put up a monument to his doctrine in celebrating the fact that he was gone for just a year and a half. He was a man from Holland who had been head of the king of the Church of Spain, and they were so disgusted with his attempts for reform that since that day, no foreigner, no non-Italian has ever been elected pope in all the four centuries since. Although in the years before that, it had been at least a third of the popes had been from various countries. But then after him, the cousin of the man who was pope when Luther was became when the Reformation began, became pope and continued for a good many years. And he was just about like his predecessor, only not quite as high character of a man. His whole interest was in advancing his family. So you see that the papacy came eventually to realize the seriousness of the situation, eventually to begin serious measures which resulted in putting an end to the very fine start the Reformation had made in Italy, and eventually to winning back the whole southern third of the territory that the Reformation took over. But it was quite a few years before that men were in the papacy who really realized the seriousness of the situation. And this is one of the forces that God used to make it possible that the little candle would become a bigger fire and eventually a conflagration that no human force available could stop. Now, see, we mentioned at the end of the hour, we just mentioned that Luther himself, at the beginning of the Reformation, had not yet realized where his studies were leading. If Luther, at the beginning of the Reformation, had come out with some of the statements that he was making 20 years later, he wrote a great book which he called The Papacy, The Invention of the Devil. And he wrote attacking the Mass as being a superstition. And he took a very, very strong stand on a great many issues before the end of his life. He attacked the idea of clerical celibacy. He attacked the type of organization of the monasteries and the convents, and thousands of monks and nuns left the convent after reading his writings. He had tremendous influence in these various ways as his thought developed as he studied all things in the light of the Word of God. But in the beginning, his first idea had been to start to get the professors to see the error of Aristotle's philosophy, which he felt underlay so much of the unbiblical teaching. And then this, which was sort of an offhand attitude of his, simply to try to protect his people from what he felt was a serious danger to them, was his questioning this whole situation of the indulgences. And in the course of his thesis, he did strike at the very foundation of the idea, but it wasn't brought out or strongly stressed in him. This was what started him, and then as opposition came against him, and as he was ordered to submit to the Pope and take what the Pope says on it, his attitude originally was the Pope is a great leader of Christendom, he's a great spiritual man, and certainly if he decides, of course I'll fall in line with the decision that this great Christian leader makes. Who am I to oppose him? But as he went on and saw the attitude which the Pope took, which was one of simple authoritarianism and not of giving scriptural support for the views he presented, and as he saw some of the definitely unscriptural things the popes were presenting. And then as he began studying the decisions of previous popes and the history of the papacy and the history of various institutions, he gradually clarified his mind on these things, and as he did so, he carried many people along with him who would have been shocked in the first place and probably would have simply said, well, he's just a wild anarchist and a good thing to get rid of him if he had had his full understanding when the Reformation began. And so God used the gradual development of Luther's thinking to keep him from being destroyed at the beginning and to pull many people along with him who never would have come along if they had seen immediately of where it was all leading. But Luther sincerely stated at the beginning he was simply trying to protect his people from this definitely unbiblical thing, and most of the leading scholars knew that Tetzel had gone far beyond what had ever been supported in the theory of the church, and the attitude of many was, well, Luther is pointing out certain errors and certain wrongs, and if he goes a little strongly in his speech, well, most people have to do that to get attention, but really, there's nothing extremely radical about him. But that, of course, helped to keep the strong opposition from getting immediately underway. But then there was a political factor which was very important, and that is, small d, the unwillingness of the elector to see his leading professor killed. The unwillingness of the elector to see his leading professor killed. And under this head, I think it's a good time to say a little bit about a man who in the providence of God was one of the great factors in allowing the Reformation to get underway and not be destroyed immediately. This man was Frederick. He is usually called Frederick the Wise. I think Frederick the Shrewd would be a much more accurate translation into English of what was meant. Because I don't think you can say that Frederick was a wise man, he certainly was not a scholar. He was a well-meaning man. Frederick, we should say a little bit about his background. Two generations before Luther, I barely mentioned it once, I did not stress it. I want to stress it now. Two generations before Luther, a Duke of Saxony, which is a large section of Germany, a section that had been conquered from heathenism by Charlemagne at about 800 AD. Charlemagne had conquered it and had forced all the Saxons to become nominal Christians, but that was many centuries before this time. Saxony is a large section of Germany, which is it's not in the extreme east, but it's definitely east of the center of Germany. And it's not to the complete north of Germany, but it's north of the center. See, that gives you an idea of the section of Germany, which is Saxon, where the Saxons lived. They were a people, a large Germanic tribe, which had been outside of the Roman Empire, and which had been conquered by Charlemagne, and then had been an important part of Germany since the time of Charlemagne, about 7 or 8 centuries before the Reformation began. Now this area had been controlled by a duke who was also an elector. That is to say, if an emperor died, he was one of the group of about a dozen men who had the right to cast votes for the election of a new emperor. And once an emperor was elected and was crowned by the Pope in Rome, he was theoretically head of the whole of the Roman Empire, including practically all of the then known world outside of Asia, and outside of Asia and a very small part of Eastern Europe. He was the nominally that, though actually his power as emperor was not very great. But this Duke of Saxony could not bring himself to give all his power to his oldest son and leave the younger son without any, so he divided his realm in two parts, and he made a crazy sort of a line across it, a waving line this way across it, so that north of the line there was one part, south of the line there was another part, and these two sections were under different rulers, his two sons. And then their two sons were really ruling there in the time of Luther. So you had now two dukes of Saxony who were cousins. And of these two dukes, One of them was called Frederick the Wise, and the other came to be called George the Steadfast. And the reason they call him Steadfast is because he was so steadfast in his loyalty to the Roman Church. He was ready to lose just about anything, and almost did, for his loyalty to the Roman Church. Well, George was the Duke of Saxony, and in trying to make a fair division of the territory, the grandfather had given the important cities like Dresden and Leipzig, which are two of the most important cities in East Germany today. They were two of the most important cities in Germany. Dresden and Leipzig he had given to the one brother, the one of his sons, and gave him the best territory. The other territory did not have important cities like this in it. It was a rather poor territory, but he tried to make up for that by giving him the electorship. So Frederick was an elector, and that gave him great prestige, and it gave him considerable importance when it came to the election of an emperor. Frederick was. But he did not have any great amount of money. That is, he was way ahead of people like Luther. He was definitely one of the nobility, one of the great nobles of Germany. But among them, he was one of the poorer, one of the weaker ones. But George had the great cities, but not the electorship. Now, Frederick had been anxious to build up his territory. There was a great university at Leipzig in George's territory. Frederick started a university in Wittenberg, a university which does not continue to the present day, but a university which he began and which he tried to get first-class professors, and when he succeeded in getting a man who became known all over Europe and attracted people from Denmark and Sweden and from many parts of other parts of Europe to come to study at Wittenberg, he was very happy about the advance he was making. And he had tried to make the castle church in Wittenberg an important church, and had got Staupitz go and find him relics that would attract people to him. Well, Frederick, as at the beginning, then, thus, I don't think Frederick had really much understanding of philosophical or religious matters. But he came to have a great regard for Luther. And though he only saw Luther personally once or twice in his life, he was so interested in what Luther was doing that eventually, when he would have a particular problem or trouble, he would write and ask Luther for advice on any spiritual matter. One time when he was sick, Luther wrote a series of sermons to be read to him day after day in his sickness. And I don't think there's any doubt that at least by the end of his life, Frederick was an earnest Christian, thoroughly believing in what Luther taught. But his inner details of his inner spiritual life, we don't know. And his ideas probably moved rather gradually. This made him all the greater as a defender for Luther. Because in the beginning, his attitude simply was, if my professor, if this leading professor in my university is guilty of some crime, well, he should be punished, yes. But I'm not going to take a risk in having him be convicted without true evidence of doing anything wrong. And I'm not going to have him sent off to some other region where he can be subject to perhaps an attack by designing people, or perhaps be put out of the way as many people have been done before. So Frederick the Wise was not known as a follower of Luther, though he undoubtedly was before the end of his life, which was only about 7 or 8 years later. But he was known as a man of considerable prestige in Germany, who was determined that his professor would have fair play. And so Frederick the Wise was clever or shrewd in thinking up excuses to keep from sending Luther to Rome for examination. He'd say, well, Luther is not in very good health, and the long trip wouldn't be good for him. If there's something against him, send the witnesses here. Let me examine. We'll look into it carefully and thoroughly here if there's something wrong. But I can't risk the life of my eminent professor by having him make the long trip down. And one reason after another, he gave. And his protection of Luther without it, humanly speaking, the Reformation would have been killed very soon. Now, Frederick, it so happened that about less than 2 years after the Reformation began, the emperor died. And when the emperor died, the great lords of different parts of Germany didn't want any one of them to have a leading position, unless he was elected emperor, of course. And so they made Frederick, whom everybody respected, the administrator of the empire. And he was administrator of the empire for a period of a good many months before a new emperor was elected. And when the new emperor was elected, naturally he looked to Frederick. He was a young fellow, only 20, 21 years of age, and he looked to Frederick as one whom he regarded very highly and whom he did not want to displease unnecessarily, even though he was dead against Luther and everything Luther stood for. So that Frederick the Wise was an important factor in the fact that the Reformation got started. Now, the relation between Frederick and his cousin and the attitude of the cousin, Luke George, is something that enters in at many points in the subsequent history. And so these details, these main details of the political situation, are important for understanding the subsequent history. And that's why I took quite so long on them at this point. Now, that was C. That was D, wasn't it? Then E is the overshadowing importance of the election of an emperor. The overshadowing importance of the election of an emperor. It was the end of October 1517 when the theses were posted. And in January 1519, as you see, a little over a year later, Emperor Maximilian died. And he had been in poor health for a time. People were expecting that Maximilian would be gone and there would be the question, who would be the next emperor? And when Maximilian actually died, there was all kinds of maneuvering. And the Pope actually was much more concerned with who would be the next emperor than he was with what would happen to Luther. And the Pope wanted to have a weak emperor, because the Pope wanted to be considered superior to the emperor. And so he was anxious. He opposed the election of the man who was elected. And all this maneuvering, as you see, took up the attention of the people who could have jumped in with force to destroy Luther. And so the fact that right at this time, in the providence of God, a change might be made which would be tremendously important for the whole future history of Germany and Italy, politically, seemed to people at that time, at least seemed to all the political leaders, and to the leaders in the church, to be such an important matter that what Luther was doing seemed to them a comparatively small factor. But meantime, Luther was using the new instrument of printing, which had come into existence only a few decades before. He was, when something important would happen, he'd write a little article about it, or a little book, or a pamphlet, and he would issue it. And it would be distributed, and people would read it. And actually, within a very few years, the number of books printed in Europe just about doubled. And about half of the publications that were appearing were actually by Luther. And so his influence was spreading during these years, when the political leaders and the heads of the church did not realize that, looked at from the viewpoint of a century or two later, what Luther had done was 100 times more important than who would be elected emperor. Well, so much then for this matter, why Luther was not quickly silenced, number two. Number one. Now, number two is the first attempt to silence Luther. The first attempt to silence Luther. Now, to look at the history of the details of this period at length would take a long time and you wouldn't remember. And I'm just going to summarize it more or less, mention a few of the main things. The first of them, small a, is the meeting at Heidelberg. The meeting at Heidelberg. This was in April and May 1518, to be about 6 months after the theses were put up. This came about because the authorities in Rome sent word to the Augustinian order. And they said, there's trouble coming. There's one of your monks up there has been distributing material that is causing a dissension. Now you look into it. Let the order look into it and straighten out the matter and put an end to this trouble. And so they gave a call for Luther, for all the leaders of the Augustinian order of Germany to meet at Heidelberg, which was a trip of maybe 200 miles from Wittenberg. And Luther went there to Heidelberg, and there he was received by the local leaders with considerable honor. And he was given opportunity to present his views to the Augustinians, and a great many of them were proud that one in their order should get so much attention as this, and should bring out things that would make it necessary to think through seriously the indulgence matter, which had not been properly thought through, and everybody knew there had been a good many errors in connection with. They knew that many of the indulgences certainly were contrary to any true understanding, and here he was bringing people to think the thing through properly. And so the Augustinian order tended to favor their man, Luther. But in the meetings in Heidelberg, some from other orders came to the meeting. And we might mention here a man who was a Dominican. Now, the Dominican was the order that Tetzel belonged to. But one of the Dominicans at Heidelberg came to the meeting and heard Luther and was tremendously impressed. And this man is a man who is not one of the great Reformation leaders. But if you would name five great Reformation leaders up here and then name a dozen in the next category, whoever selected would certainly include him in one of the dozen, and perhaps high up in the list. And so he's a man that I believe we ought to be aware of. His name was Martin Butzer. The way it sounds is the way Dovini does it, B-U-T-Z-E-R. But it's more usually spelled B-U-C-E-R. Martin Butzer, B-U-C-E-R. He is a man of real influence, though not one of the very top leaders in the Reformation in Germany. In connection with Luther, he has an important connection with Calvin later, and he has an important place in the Reformation in England. So here we have three important aspects of the Reformation, in every one of which Butzer has an important, though not a top place. If you put together his importance in all three of these and put it under any one, he would be one of the outstanding figures. As it is, he is not widely known, but you can't read an account of either of these three elements, the aspect of the Reformation, without coming across his name. And he was won to the Reformation through Luther speaking here at Heidelberg. So this attempt really didn't accomplish much. Now small b, the master of the palace. The Master of the Palace, this is the name of an official at Rome. An official in Rome who said, this is terrible the way this money is falling off from the indulgences. And he said, this man Luther is all mixed up in his theology. He said, why not let me write something to straighten it all up? The Pope said, that's fine, go ahead. And so this man wrote a set of statements, how, which really boiled down to this, that after all, the Pope had given the indulgence and that proved they were all right. But he used a good many words saying it, and Luther wrote an answer to what he wrote, and it really didn't accomplish much. But number C was a little more important, John X. Obelisks. John X. Obelisks. This is a man of whom we will hear more a little later, yes? E-C-K. E-C-K. Now that's not his name, but that's what he's always called. His name was John, and he came from a town called Eck. And so they named him John Eck. They referred to him by the name of the town, as they often did to these different men. There was a man who was a secretary to the Elector Frederick, who came from the town of Spalat, and they called him Spalatin, the man from Spalat. And he and Luther became good friends, and Luther wrote hundreds of letters to him. That's one of our best sources for details of the period. His letters to the man, to George Burkhardt, who they always call Spalatin. But this man they call Eck, and he was a professor in South Germany. Luther had thought he was a progressive forward-looking, intelligent man and had sent him a copy of his first thesis. But John Eck, to Luther's surprise and everyone's surprise, immediately wrote attacking Luther's thesis. He wrote what he called his obelisks, taking up the thesis and discussing them and trying to show that they are wrong. And Luther wrote an answer to this, and it did not accomplish much as yet. But John Eck becomes important a little later. Now, this was March 1518 when these came out, and it was determined in the meantime they had been writing to Frederick and saying, send Frederick down to Rome. We want to send Luther down. We've got to investigate this. Frederick says, I'd like to do anything your holiness desires. I'm certainly anxious to advance the welfare of the church, but my professor is not in good health. Excellent lecturer, a great ornament to the university. I simply can't risk something happening to him along the way, if catching disease or something on the way. And please let us know what you have against him, and I will investigate it thoroughly. And the correspondence went back and forth. And so now, small d, is Cardinal Thomas DeVio. Thomas, small d-e, capital V-I-O. Now, Thomas DeVio was also called Cajetan, C-A-J-E-T-A-N. Cajetan is what he's usually called. I believe, though, that Dobini calls him by his proper name, DeVio. But Cardinal Thomas DeVio was a scholar in Rome, a man who was highly regarded, and they said, you go up to Germany and straighten this matter out. And it's a little hard with the fine things we read about Cajetan elsewhere. It's a little hard to see why he acted quite the way he did in relation to Luther. Whether he felt he didn't want to get mixed in this thing, whether he felt the Pope had given him a job to do and he must get it done with, just why, it's hard to understand. Because if he had come to Luther and had discussed the matter with Luther as two men of intellectual insight discussing a problem together, he would have found Luther extremely reasonable. And that's what Luther expected when he heard this fine scholar, this cardinal from Italy, was coming up and wanted to see him and wanted him to go to Augsburg in South Germany to meet with him. Luther looked forward to discussing the matter with this man who had such a reputation for intelligence. And he thought, surely he will look at things reasonably, and if I'm wrong, he'll give me evidence and show me I am. And if I am right, he will see it and will stand for it. But Cajetan asked, they asked that Luther go to appear before Cajetan. And Frederick said, no, I can't let Luther out of my territory. Something might happen to him. I cannot do it. He said, the only thing is if we can get an imperial safe conduct. And so he asked the Emperor Maximilian to give him an assurance that Luther could safely go to Augsburg and safely return, giving him a certain length of time to do it. And the Emperor raised questions about it, the old Emperor, and he was not very well known anyway. It took quite a while to get the safe conduct. But Frederick insisted on that Luther not run into any danger whatever by going to Augsburg to meet Cajetan. Yes? This is the old emperor, Maximilian. This is still the old emperor, Maximilian. He died in January 1519. This is October 1518. Yes. And so Luther went down to Augsburg, and Staupitz, the head of the order, went with him. And they got there, and he was invited to meet with Cajetan, but a secretary to Cajetan, an Italian named Urban de Serralonga, I don't think there's any point in your trying to note down his name, he saw Luther, and he explains Luther. He says, your business here may be summed up in one word of six letters, recant. Luther said, but may I not defend my position or at least be instructed on it? Urban said, do you think this a game of running in a ring? Don't you know it's all right to deceive the people a little, as you say the preachers of indulgence do, to get their money? Do you think the Elector Frederick will take arms to protect you? Luther said, I hope not. Urban said, if not, where will you live? Luther said, under heaven. Urban said, what would you do if you had the Pope and cardinals in your pocket? He said, I would show them all reverence and honor. Urban, with a scornful gesture, said, him. And Urban tried to tell him, the thing for you to do is simply to tell the cardinal you're ready to take what the Pope said and be done. Well, Luther tried to show the cardinal that there had been no great church declaration explaining exactly how far indulgences could go and where they should stop, and that they were being completely misunderstood anyway. The cardinal refused to discuss with Luther. Three different times Luther met with the cardinal. And every time the cardinal simply said, my son, we don't want to hurt you. We do want the welfare of the church. We want you to put yourself in line. And it's going to be pretty hard for you if you don't. So we want you to recant. Say that you will give up everything you've taught that's hurting the church. And Luther said, show me from the scripture what the truth is. I'm only too ready to see anything in the Bible that's clearly taught there. I want to see the facts. I'm presenting it as well as I understand it. And if I misunderstand, I'm only too anxious to have more light. And Cajetan simply said, the only thing for you to do, the Pope has spoken, the Pope has given the indulgences, you recant. Well, Luther said, I can't do that. He said, my conscience won't permit me to. And so after three very unsatisfactory meetings this way with Cajetan, Luther came out and told Spalatin what had happened. And Spalatin, who realized the seriousness of the situation, immediately said, as head of the Augustinian order in Germany, I am now absolving you from your vows of obedience to the order. You are now a free man with no responsibility to the Augustinian order, but neither does the order have any responsibility for what you do. And thus, Spalatin absolved Luther from his vows of obedience to the order and set Luther and absolved the order from any responsibility to try to protect Luther. Yes, sir?
No.
Excuse me. Thanks, Stalpin. Thank you very much. Stalpin, not Stalpin. Of course, Spalatin could not do anything like that. This is Stalpin, the head of the order. And when I make a slip like that, please call my attention to it. Spalatin is the chaplain to the Elector Frederick. And he's the man to whom Luther wrote on all these occasions telling him exactly what happened. And Luther had very little correspondence with Frederick, but he had a great deal with Spalatin, who was one of his very best friends. Well, when Luther got back, he wrote an appeal from the Pope ill-informed to the Pope better-informed. But when Cajetan got back to Italy, he said to the Pope, Luther has got a big point there. There has never been a definite official decision on this matter of indulgence. It's sort of grown up. And he said, if you're going to deal with Luther as you want, you better make a formal official statement on the matter. And so the Pope issued a bull. The word bull comes from the seal, the type of seal that was put on the papal documents. Right? So they call it a papal bull. A papal declaration. He made a declaration declaring that the Pope had the right to issue these indulgences, and the indulgences would do everything the Pope said they would. He made an official doctrinal statement about it, so that after this you could say Luther was going against an official declaration of the Pope. But before, there had not been any such official declaration at any time. So Cajetan saw the need of that, pointed that out to the Pope. But then there was, yes, small e then, the bull of November 9, 1518. You see, it was not long after Cajetan got back to Italy that the Pope issued this bull, declaring that what Luther had been attacking was proper church doctrine, even though it had never previously been officially so declared to be. Now, if is Charles von Miltitz, M-I-L-T-I-T-Z. Charles von Miltitz was a German of noble blood, but not any special wealth or standing. A German who was had been in Italy for some years, and who was a papal chamberlain. That is, he had an important position in the papal household. And Miltitz came to the Pope, and he said, I know these Germans. I'm one of them. And he said, if you would let me go and talk to these people, I think we can straighten this all up. Now this is nearly, this is a year and a little more after the adults were, the theses were posted. He says, I think we can straighten this all up, he says. There are two monks in Germany here who are fighting each other. Men from two different orders, Augustinian and Dominican, and they're raising all kinds of intellectual questions. But he says, things like this, you want to handle on a personal basis. He says, you want to get in and see what the real situation is and talk to the men, and you can usually straighten it out, he says, if you handle it that way as a personal matter and show them what they're going to lose if they go on the wrong way and get them to go as far as they will in making promises. He says, I think I can quiet the whole thing up. And so the Pope said, well, he said, let's try it. So he said, I will give you authority to represent me in certain matters in Germany. And he said, I want you to go up officially. The purpose of your going is to carry the golden rose to Frederick. Now, the Pope used to quite frequently give a golden rose to some ruler somewhere in Europe. And this was a great honor for the Pope to give him the golden rose. And he knew that the new election of a new emperor was near, and he was anxious that Frederick should be amenable to his desires in the matter. So he thought he'd give him an honor by sending him the golden rose. So Miltitz came up to give the golden rose to Frederick, but with authority to talk to these two monks, Tetzel and Luther, and straighten the thing up between them. So he went to see Tetzel. And he said to Tetzel, he said, what's the matter with you anyway? He said, you've been making all kinds of trouble here with all this preaching that went way beyond what the church has ever declared to be proper. He said, you've been raising lots of money, much of it on statements that simply aren't feasible. He said, maybe Saralonga is right that it's all right to deceive the people a little to get their money. But he said, you deceived them a great deal. You went to the point where you've caused all this trouble. Oh, he just poured into Tetzel. And Tetzel now was living in one of the Dominican monasteries. He couldn't go out on the street with the kids would throw stones at him, and people would yell at him, and he just was the poor fellow. He received his doctor's degree for writing theses exactly opposite of what Luther had on everything, but there was nothing he could do to get him anywhere, and Miltitz just tore into him for all the trouble he said Tetzel had made. And then he came to see Luther. And then he talked to Luther, and he said to Luther now, he says, you don't want to hurt the church, do you? Luther said, of course not. I have no desire to hurt the church. I just want to stand for the truth on these matters. And Miltitz says, that's right. Of course you want to stand for the truth, and we want to stand for the truth, too. But he said, we don't want to hurt the church. And all this argument and dissension is hurting. Now he said, I've talked to Tetzel. Tetzel has written these theses attacking Luther's theses. He says, I've told him to stop all this. I've made him quiet down and told him he mustn't have any more of this. Now he says, why don't you do the same? And then we'll have peace in the church. And Luther said, well, he said, I can't go against my conscience. Well, Miltitz says, you've expressed yourself. You've satisfied your conscience. You've told the world what you think about these things. Why do you have to keep on agitating about them? And so after considerable discussion, Luther agreed to two things. First, both sides would be inhibited from preaching, writing, and acting farther in the matter. He agreed to keep quiet, provided the other said. Provided they don't attack his views or himself, he would not attack them. Second, Miltitz will write the Pope at once, informing him how things stand, asking him to recommend the matter to some learned bishop who will hear me and point out the specific errors, if I make them, that I should retract. He says, when I've learned my mistake, I'll gladly withdraw them. I don't want to do anything to impair the honor and power of the Roman Church. And so Miltitz felt that he had satisfied the situation pretty well. And he felt that now both sides would keep silent and the matter would quiet down. And Miltitz felt he had been very successful in this. But he soon found that he hadn't been successful in it. But it looked for a little bit as if he had. Well, now number three, the development of Luther's thought. During this time, Luther was forced by these things to think things through rather fully. And as he thought them through and studied and looked for scriptural evidence in support. Yes, the question? M-I-L-T-I-T-Z. M-I-L-T-I-T-Z. as Luther was coming to wonder, after all, how much is there that has grown up in the church that is superstition and not built on biblical teaching? And he was looking at different matters, and his thought was developing, but now, for the next few months, he published nothing, and he made no public utterances that would advance dissension or disruption within the church. All this was brought to an end, however, by a new development. A new development which completely undid everything that Tetzel had done. Now, of course, during those next few months of 1519, people everywhere were tremendously excited about who's going to be the next emperor. But Luther was studying, and there was this man, John Eck, we've already mentioned, who wrote against Luther. John Eck now decided that he would like to have a debate, and he wanted to debate Luther, but Luther had said, I will keep quiet on these matters as long as the other side does. And so he found that Luther had an associate called John Bodenstein. This is number four, the Leipzig debate. Number four, the Leipzig debate. And under number four, we will mention as small a John Bodenstein of Karlstadt. Now, John Bodenstein was brought up in a city called Karlstadt, C-A-R-L-S-T-A-D-T. And for everybody that's ever heard the name John Bodenstein, there are at least a dozen who are familiar with the word Karlstadt, because everybody just called him Karlstadt, the city he'd come from. And so we will do that from now on. But John Bodenstein of Karlstadt had come to Wittenberg, C-A-R-L-S-T-A-D-T. C-A-R-L-S-T-A-D-T. John Karlstadt, as they called him, instead of John Bodenstein, which was his real name, he had come as a professor at the university. And when he came, he was shocked at Luther's teaching, which was contrary to what Karlstadt had received in school. And Karlstadt had simply gone along in the old standard line up to that time. He was a pretty good student, and he came to be a professor in the university, and he was shocked at Luther and tried to oppose Luther when he first was a professor. But after a little, he saw that Luther was certainly right, and he saw that he couldn't hold his own against Luther, so he swung right over, not to Luther's side, but went beyond Luther on a lot of matters. And Karlstadt began writing and distributing material, supporting Luther's views, but going often making statements that he could not really thoroughly defend. He was not at all in Luther's class intellectually. And Eck could not get Luther to debate with him because Luther had promised that if the other side kept quiet, he would keep quiet too. So Eck wrote to Karlstadt, and he said, Karlstadt, would you have a debate with me over these matters? And Karlstadt was very happy with the prospect, and happily agreed to have the debate with him. And they looked around for a place to have the debate. Oh, this I maybe we might call small b X challenge. Small b X challenge. Where would they have it? So they looked around and made inquiries, and they managed to get an invitation. X got an invitation from the University of Leipzig. Leipzig, L-E-I-P-Z-I-G. 40 years ago, Leipzig was the book capital of the world. I guess probably Frankfurt would be now, I don't know. But Leipzig was until it was taken over by the communists after World War II. They used to have the great fairs at Leipzig where they brought industry from all over the world. Its university was one of the leading universities in the world. Leipzig was one of the two great cities in Duke George's territory. And so Duke George agreed that they would have this debate there between Karlstadt and Eck in Leipzig. And so Karlstadt, they got a wagon, some horses to draw. Karlstadt went along, took some books. Luther went along with them. And they, people went, quite a little group of them. And they got to Leipzig and they met Eck there. Small c, a rival in Leipzig. Well, by this time, Luther hadn't been saying much for about 6 months, and rumors had been spreading. And when he got to Leipzig, the story was that he carried the devil in a little box in his hip pocket. You better not get too near him, he might open the box. And the people were afraid of their lives of Luther. He was a notorious heretic and one who was opposing the Pope. And the general attitude was they were anxious to see what he looked like, but they didn't want to have anything to do with it. There was a great opposition to him among the people in Leipzig. But Duke George, as the host, received the party from Wittenberg very graciously and gave them a dinner and various festivities, and then they started the debate, which lasted several days. And in the debate, Eck was able to pretty well demolish Karl Stott's arguments. And it was very obvious to everyone that Eck, as a debater, as a scholar, as a thinker, was way superior to Karl Stott. And here was Luther sitting there, and Luther was the real man Eck wanted to get at. And you could see from Luther's face and from his attitude at different points that what Karl Stott was saying, he could have said twice as well. And Eck said, "Can't we talk with Luther about this? Can't you permit Luther to talk?" And when Eck made certain personal attacks on Luther, which Luther felt absolved him from his promise to keep quiet if the other side would keep quiet too, and when Duke George gave his permission to let Luther speak, Luther took over. And so the last half of the debate, Luther spoke against Eck. And this is what Eck wanted. Eck wanted to make a great name for himself by completely demolishing Luther. And so when Luther would present a view, Eck would begin quoting from papal statements to show that Luther was opposing not merely the present pope, but other popes in the past. And he pushed Luther to say, "Yes, a pope may be wrong. That pope was wrong, what you quote. It isn't in line with the scripture." And then he began quoting from church councils. And Luther had to say, "Well, a church council could be wrong." When he said that, George blurted out. He couldn't keep quiet. Does anybody say that a great church council could do what was wrong? That just shocked George. He hated Luther for the next 20 years. Did the best he could to have him destroyed. But in the end, the debate was all written up in shorthand, written out in longhand, and sent to the University of Paris to decide who won the debate. But I don't know if the decision was ever made on it. It didn't matter if it did. What they did was to make the positions come out in clear relief, to put an end to Luther's time of necessary silence, and to force Luther to the recognition that church councils, as well as popes, may err, and that, after all, the Bible is the one source of knowledge in religious things. We can see that.